Christopher Media. Let's make some noise.
For the first time in screen history, a special interval will be provided during the running of this picture for refunding your admission. If you're unable to stand the almost unbearable suspense, the almost paralyzing shock of homicidal.
If homicide is your hobby, may I recommend a surgical knife for a nice, clean, quiet murder. I'm William Castle, and this wheelchair is just to rest my tired nerves after producing a picture like this one. We are so sure you will find it such a shocking and startling experience that we are offering a money-back guarantee when you come to see Homicidal. At the height of the suspense, there will be a fright break, an interval during which you can quiet your nerves. If you are too frightened to see the end of the picture, your full admission price will be refunded. Time to go downstairs now. Got a date to carve a corpse.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me is Mr. Rob St. Mary.
You know, Psycho's come in all kinds of packages.
Also back with us this week is our good friend, Mr. Jeffrey Schwartz.
Greetings, my homicidal friends.
This week we are looking at the 1961 film from William Castle, Homicidal. It's the story of a murderous woman who has a score to settle with those who threaten the love of her life. Well, kind of. Let's just put it out there right now that we're going to get into spoilers on this one big time. If you haven't seen Homicidal, we're going to encourage you to go out and see it right now. It's available as like a 5-movie combo for $12 over on Amazon. It's available other means as well, I'm sure. So go ahead and watch it, then come back, and we'll still be here. All right, if you're still with us, then you know that Homicidal is actually the story of a woman, Emily, who was treated as a man most of her life and is killing anyone who might say different, from the doctor that delivered her to the sadistic nanny who raised her to her sister Miriam. Miriam Webster. I could not stop laughing every time they said Miriam Webster. Anyway, Jeffrey, as our guest, when was the first time you saw Homicidal and what did you think?
Well, I used to run our campus film series at the State University at Purchase. And so we used to rent these 16mm films, and this was before any of these William Castle movies were available on video. So the only way to see them was to get the print. So we got The Tingler and 13 Ghosts and Homicidal, and I believe that was the first time that I ever saw Homicidal was on the big screen on 16mm. And we also got a print of William Castle promoting Homicidal at in Youngstown, Ohio, at a theater where he was interviewing terrified patrons after they had just emerged from seeing the movie.
Now, let me ask you a question. Were you holding his hands throughout the picture?
I was holding him back. He was running out.
Did you guess the surprise ending?
I had some ideas about it, but I wasn't sure.
How about you?
No, I didn't have any idea the way this picture ended.
What was the most delightful piece of mayhem in the entire picture?
Oh, I don't know. I guess the ending sure built up the whole suspense.
will you tell your friends the ending of this picture?
Oh, no. Never.
No, I'll let them suffer through it.
Mr. Castle, I'd like to congratulate you on a fine piece of production. I think Alfred Hitchcock is going to have to go a long way to try and top something like this.
Well, thank you very much. That's very nice of you to say.
That's kind of where the William Castle obsession began, is back in college.
Well, I had seen sort of all of the other films that Jeffrey mentions, except for this one. This one, I guess, kind of slipped under the radar for me. I mean, the other ones like The Tingler and all of that and 13 Ghosts are all, I guess, maybe the more well-known ones because there's a bigger gimmick involved. This one, I think, doesn't have quite the gimmick, and it is very connected to another film that came out, I think, just before it, although it has its own twist in how it's done. And, of course, I think we'll be talking about that.
Now, Rob, did you know, watching this, because I, years ago, when Spine Tingler, the William Castle story, a.k.a. Jeff's documentary, when that came out, I found out what the twist of this movie was. Did you know going in what the twist was?
No, I had absolutely no idea, because it was the first time I had seen it, and I just went in cold. And I have to say that the ending was quite a twist for me. So I was like, wow, didn't see that coming. Although when I put it together in my head, I go, oh, okay. There's elements all throughout it that build to get you there.
When you saw Warren, the character of Warren, did there anything strike you as strange about him? Or did you just sort of buy it that he was a male character?
Well, when I saw it, I thought, well, he's a bit effeminate. I thought maybe that, and we can get into sort of the, the gay aspects or, you know, the obvious trans aspects in here. I just thought, well, he's just a fair-looking guy, you know what I mean? Like, he just seemed like kind of that 50s stereotype of sort of the of the gay character who isn't really expressed that he is gay. It's just sort of a given that the audience knows.
Which kind of throws some of the stuff about him and his wedding into some doubt as well, because it's like there's that relationship between him and Emily. And at one point you find out that they're married and it's like, oh, that's kind of a shocker. And you're thinking that's kind of a shocker for one reason when it's actually another reason. When I watched this with my wife yesterday, she had never seen the film and she didn't know the twist either. And she was just like, man, that Warren is a real creepy guy. And I'm like, oh, okay. And I didn't know if it was just because his voice was so different, you know, the way that they overdubbed all of Warren's lines, or if it was his look or what was going on. But she just did not like Warren when he was on screen, which I found very amusing. And of course, I didn't tell her the twist. So I'm just sitting there like basically watching the movie and watching her at the same time.
He's wearing these really strange false teeth also. And then that was the other thing that is sort of off about him. It's the voice, which is obviously dubbed, and it's those false teeth. And every time he comes on screen, you just can't quite put your finger on what's going on with him.
Warren, what are you doing here?
I was just driving up to Helga's. I thought I'd stop by and see Miriam first. What happened? Who made the mess in the shop?
I said, I'd like to know.
And he isn't in the movie for a long time. Like, they talk about Warren quite a bit. And it's good that they don't really reveal him for a while, because we really start off with this whole other mystery thing that's going on. And I love the way that this film begins, where we have Emily going through the town and she goes up to this window and looks at these wedding bands, and she goes into this hotel and negotiates for a hotel price, which is interesting to me that, you know, it's like, well, $3, is that okay? Well, what's the nicer hotel? Oh, that's what, $750 for the suite or whatever. It's like, oh my God, these prices are amazing. And she is making these moves big time on this bellboy and offers to pay him $2,000 to marry her like the night of the September 6th, and it's now September 5th. And they make this big deal about the day, and they make a big deal because before we even get to that, there's a little prologue, which I don't know about you, Rob, but as I was watching the prologue, for some reason, I was reminded of Deep Red, even though we didn't have the shot of the feet and everything, but it just seemed like this prologue is really going to set up a whole lot of things, and we're not really going to know what's going on until much later in the film.
Oh, yeah. The prologue's interesting because there's actually sort of like two parts to it. There's the thing with the kids playing and the whole doll thing that's really kind of creepy. And you're like, okay. And that takes a while to finally pay off. You really have to remember that, but I think he does a good enough job sort of searing that into your head so that when it comes up later, you're like, ah, okay. And then there's the whole thing with Castle, and you don't know exactly what he's doing. It just looks like he's pulling thread or whatever. And then you find that he's basically doing the old sort of like wall hanging sampler thing that, you know, people would have in their homes. And that's the title of the film. So I thought that was interesting way to integrate himself in that way, in sort of, I guess, what Hitchcock would do with his little cameos. But this is a much more direct thing. And it almost kind of felt like an intro to a TV show more than what you normally see with a film.
Well, he was definitely inspired by Hitchcock. I mean, Hitchcock was well on his way to being a personality that people knew as a director. And Hitchcock Castle had a kind of a jealousy of Hitchcock and admiration / jealousy of Hitchcock's career, and was certainly inspired by his personal appearances. And Castle started putting himself in the movie after Hitchcock did. But then we can talk about later that, you know, maybe Hitchcock started taking some cues from Castle after a while.
So we have this great intro with her wanting to get married, and that's this whole mystery thing, because I'm just like, what is going on? And the way that it's set up, I kind of knew that she was after that one particular justice of the peace who was going to do the ceremony. But I did not expect that she pulls out a knife in the middle of this thing and just starts stabbing this guy. I was completely blown away by the violence of this murder and just how everybody is there screaming and not knowing what the hell to do. And she gets away scot-free.
It's shocking. That's actually one of the most violent scenes I had seen in a movie of that period. You know, I mean, Psycho is famous for sort of, you think you see the knife going in the shower scene, but in this one, you actually do see the knife going in to the justice of the peace, and there's blood everywhere, and people are screaming. I mean, I can only imagine audiences were just not used to this kind of thing, this level of mayhem, and I would imagine that it just produced chaos in the audience when it was first shown.
One of the things about the tone in here, it really kind of felt to me like a Tales from the Crypt kind of comic book. It had that same kind of, I don't know, like look or idea or feeling like of reading those Tales from the Crypt, those EC comics from like the late 1950s. It almost feels like it lives in that same kind of universe, and this could have actually been one of those from that comic book series in a way.
Some of the lighting in this section is a little flat to me, but even then, there's some really good use of foreground, midground, background here, like especially when we have the bellboy in the room with her. Like he's gone out to get some ice and he comes back after an indeterminate time and she's in the bathroom changing, and we get her from the back all the way in the background and he's in the foreground with this ice bucket. And I thought that was really well shot. There was just a nice look to that. And then also we kind of get echoes of that later on in the film with I think it's Warren changing, and we just see him from the back. So that's kind of like our tell there that there's more of a connection between those two characters.
Yeah, I agree with you on the sort of flatness of the lighting. My friend George Kuchar used to call William Castle's lighting bar mitzvah lighting. It would basically be just like one light blasted on people. But you know, he did start in film noir, and he did have although at this point he was kind of cranking these films out as quickly as he possibly could, he did have a really strong visual sense, and he knew how to tell a story visually. I mean, he had worked with Orson Welles and Lady from Shanghai. So, you know, the movie has these really interesting visual touches.
Well, I think we're going to go 180 degrees away from that flatness when we get to that end scene when we have Miriam in that house, and just the lights and the shadows in there are almost characters, just the way that they're moving around. And we don't necessarily know, you know, what's a shadow of a person, what's a shadow from an object. And it just is kind of crazy as far as the thickness of the shadows and how she interacts with them as she moves through that room. So it's nice that we kind of start off flat and we kind of build up the same way that the tension of the film is going to build from the beginning to the end, and we're left hanging there with this murder mystery, and we don't necessarily know why she went after this guy and how crazy is she, and her coming back into, you know, her regular life. And that's a great escape scene too, her switching vehicles and being chased by, well, she thinks she's being chased by the police, and it ends up that the police are actually pulling someone else over. really nice. And of course, that again to me was a big echo to Psycho as well, as far as her driving with that police siren and that music going over the whole top. Unfortunately, the score wasn't necessarily as driving as the Bernard Herrmann score from Psycho, but it was an effective score nonetheless.
Yeah, I love the idea that the icy blonde in this movie is actually the killer rather than the victim. Just one of many nods to Psycho that are certainly intentional.
So we go back into her life and then just trying to figure out what's going on with her. And we're pretty quickly introduced to this character, Helga, who, what she got, like a doorknob or something that she's knocking on her wheelchair with?
Yeah. And I get, when I saw this character, I laughed because it reminded me of a guy that we had as a guest on the show in the past year, who was, if you go back and you listen to the full interview with Mark Margolis, who played Hector Salamanca on Breaking Bad. I was almost reminded of that character he had, who after he has the stroke, he just rings the bell that he has attached to his wheelchair. And as he gets more and more angry, he just rings the bell more and more. And instead of that, she's got this half of, you know, this doorknob, and she just bangs it on the handle there. Yeah.
I always wondered about that actress. I mean, she seems like she has quite a presence. I don't know that much about her, but she was a working actor for quite some time. And I always wondered what her voice is, what her speaking voice was like. I bet she was a formidable presence on stage.
I have to ask you, Jeffrey, was she the same woman who played that kind of, oh, I don't even know what you would call her, but like the ghost or specter or something, like the woman that's kind of wheeled in? Oh, God, is that 13 Ghosts or House on Haunted Hill, I think it is.
Yeah, I know. That's like the housekeeper in the House on Haunted Hill. No, that's not the same actress. I don't know who this woman is, but, you know, there's also the mute in The Tingler. So I think the writer, Rob White, might have had a fascination with these kinds of characters.
This is also the first place when Emily goes in and reveals to Helga that she killed this guy, and she is just so happy that she killed this guy. This is the first instance where we get a fade to black, and I'm just like, okay, what the hell just happened? Like, am I watching the TV cut of this movie or something? And was he doing fades to black between acts here? I was trying to figure out exactly where these fades were coming.
I don't know. Maybe he was trying to make it easier to sell to TV, to cut to commercial.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a good question.
After a horrific and bloody murder where the guy's just stabbed repeatedly in the gut. Sure. That kind of threw me off. But then that really does kind of set up, okay, here's act two. Now we're in this small California town and we have this whole family drama going on. We have all this stuff with Miriam coming in, and we've got Emily, who's really kind of Emily is an interloper in this instance, because we have the brother, Warren, who we have yet to see, who seems to be like this sainted son. The way that they talk about Warren, both Emily and Miriam are talking about Warren like he is just like God's gift. And we hear about him so much, and Emily is just there taking care of Helga. And eventually she talks Miriam into watching Helga for a while, then she takes off and goes off God knows where, at least to Miriam, that's how it appears. And there's this whole thing where she goes in and just trashes Miriam's flower shop. Emily has been making all these kind of snide remarks about how Warren paid for the first flower shop, and how if she wants to open up another one, of course Warren's going to have to pay for that one. So it's nice to realize later on, after the twist is revealed, that this is actually, you know, Warren's inner monologue coming out and kind of abusing his sister because he's kind of tired of the way that she's been using him.
That's quite a tour de force scene where she's trashing the flower shop. I just wonder if the audience has then ever thought about the fact that Emily and Warren are never in the same shot together, never in the same scene together. And I just I wonder how an audience unfamiliar with these kinds of stories would have reacted to that. To me, it's pretty obvious they're the same person. You know, when I saw it for the first time, I was not surprised at the big shock ending.
I was, but then again, I guess maybe I wasn't watching close enough. It's one of those things that I think it doesn't seem to be otherworldly, this film. It doesn't seem that could even play in. And maybe it's also a built-in bias. I mean, if I was watching this in 61 when it came out, maybe I could have picked up on it easier. But there's almost like this built-in bias for me that it's that period and everything seems so nice and normal. And of course, there's going to be a simple explanation for this. It's not going to be something like that. It just seems like a step further than what I would expect in 1961 for some reason. I don't know why.
It's radical. I mean, it certainly is radical for that time. The big reveal that I know we're not at that point in the plot yet, but when it's revealed that Emily and Warren are the same person, I don't remember ever seeing anything like that in any movie up to that point, except Psycho, obviously, was the influence. But this even goes even further. I mean, this is like a girl being raised as a boy. And that, had you ever seen anything like that in any movie up to that point?
Well, I mean, the only thing I can think of in sort of literature comparisons would have been Self-Selected, meaning like Twelfth Night or something. But I don't really remember any film to that point where someone put on that kind of disguise in that way. I mean, unless wasn't there a Dietrich film where she paraded as a man, or there was some sort of ambiguity? I can't remember. Like something in the 30s, maybe.
There were plenty of stories and films about one gender masquerading as the other. But in this case, it's a more of a transgender issue, you know, that, or at least the idea that one gender is being forced to be raised as another gender and behave that way. And sort of that creates this sort of split personality. That's something that I don't remember ever seeing before. But yeah, there had been films. There was Christopher Strong and all the way up to Yentl, you know, of one gender posing as the other. But this is something a lot weirder and more radical.
And I was going to ask on that with the end reveal and the way that the trans issue is handled. Do you think that it's handled, I guess, maybe in a respectful way that we come to understand that this person is damaged because those outside of them have treated them poorly? Or does it seem to come from, well, they're trans, so therefore they're a crazy killer?
Well, it's made clear in the movie that this situation was created through the father's hatred of women, right? That he couldn't accept the fact that he had a daughter, because he hated women, so he raised Warren Emily as a boy. I don't think the filmmakers were really thinking about it being a trans issue. That word wasn't even used then, really. Transsexual, yes. Transgender, definitely not. So I think that all of the sort of trans issues that we're talking about are more of a looking back on it. Although there are references to the most famous transgender person at that time, Christine Jorgensen, when they make these references to going back to Denmark, which is where Emily supposedly met Warren in Denmark. Everyone at the time, I think, knew what that meant, because that's where Christine Jorgensen got her sex change operation, and that was the first time that issue was ever really talked about. That was about 10 years before this. So it was certainly in the culture, and Christine Jorgensen was still very famous in the early 60s when Homicidal was made. She was doing nightclub act, I think, at the time. You know, the issues were being talked about, but in terms of it, whether it's a judgment on transgender people that, you know, trans people are crazy killers, I don't know that much thought really went into it.
Yeah, because I was looking at it through the lens of when we had discussed before with you, like celluloid closet things, where there were certain aspects of how trans or gay characters were portrayed. And then if they were murderous, did it flow from the fact that they happened to be gay, or is it something else?
Yeah, I mean, when I think of people who are forced into this situation, I'm thinking of like Henry Porter of a serial killer who was forced to wear dresses, or the young man from Sleepaway Camp. Those to me are much more modern, obviously, ideas of like the crazy trans killer. But again, it's one of those like, are they crazy because they're trans, or are they crazy period, and then they happen to exhibit these other gender roles. So I guess it's kind of getting into this gray area, because we've seen people who were killers just because they were gay in some of these earlier films, but not necessarily stepping into the trans arena.
Well, in this case, he's not randomly killing people, right? Isn't he killing people to prevent anyone from finding out? He's only killing the people who knew the secret. So he's right. Killing Helga because she was around and she was the one who delivered him. So she knew. So Helga knew that he was really a girl. And the Justice of the Peace knew. And Miriam didn't know. I was a little unclear why he was trying to kill Miriam.
Well, if he killed Miriam, then he got the entire inheritance. So really, he's being motivated by money more than anything.
Yeah, he's a greedy bastard.
I mean, Helga, she deserved a lot of punishment as well because of that whip that we see, where Warren kind of offhandedly is like, oh, I learned how to count by this whip being applied to my back. And I was like, holy shit, that's pretty fucking intense.
Yeah.
But he's just like, la la la, you know, and it's like, wow, okay, yeah, Helga really deserves shit now.
And Helga was following the orders of the father. I mean, it's a really interesting dynamic, and I was watching Helga thinking about what she would have been like before pre-stroke and that kind of sadomasochistic relationship that she must have had with Warren, you know, beating him up all the time.
But I also think that giving her that name adds this level into our head of the abusive German, you know, stereotype that we see in other places.
Yeah, we're only 14 years out from, you know, VE Day at this particular point. So it's like, yeah, okay, I'm sure that the Germans still weren't necessarily our friends.
Was Helga supposed to be from Denmark, too? Because she was...
That's what it sounded like.
It's all about Denmark. And, you know, that town where they filmed the movie, Solvang, I've been there. That's a town about an hour out of L.A. that is like a Danish town. And all those buildings that you see, those like quaint little buildings, like, I mean, they're all still there. So I'm just fascinated to know how much of the Christine Jorgensen story was an influence on Rob White, who wrote this script, and particularly the use of Denmark as a story point.
And White had worked with Castle quite a few times to this point.
He wrote all the movies. Yeah, they started working together on Macabre. And then they kept working together, and Homicidal was the last one that they worked on together. I think their relationship kind of soured at some point. I think Rob White felt he wasn't getting he was getting short shrift as a contributor to the films. And then I believe after this they stopped working together. I mean, after this one was Mr. Sardonicus and Straightjacket, and he didn't write those movies.
Mr. Sardonicus was the same damn year. I mean, Castle must have been working like a fiend.
Oh yeah, he was actually, and this was the sort of the peak of his notoriety as a director, producer, showman, and you know they all had gimmicks, and this was like right in the middle of that his gimmick heyday, and this one had a great gimmick which I'm sure we'll talk about.
I mean, yeah, looking at Castle's filmography and seeing two movies a year. You know, like 13 Ghosts in 1960 was one film, but then things like The Tingler and House on Haunted Hill, both in 59, Sardonicus and Homicidal, both in 61, Dark Old House and 13 Frightened Girls, both in 63, Nightwalker and Straightjacket, both in 64. I mean, this guy was just going with these films.
Well, I feel like this was kind of a transitional film because, you know, from Macabre, House on Haunted Hill, The Tingler, 13 Ghosts, those were all kind of, they had adult themes, but I think the audience was mainly kids. And the gimmicks were kind of geared toward the kids. You know, The Tingler with the buzzing seats, and House on Haunted Hill had the skeleton flying over the audience, and 13 Ghosts had the special glasses where you could see the ghosts or not see the ghosts if you're too scared. And Homicidal, it had a gimmick, but this was like, this is not a movie for kids. You know, I would imagine the kids going to see this. This was a whole different kind of William Castle movie, and certainly inspired by Psycho, and inspired by, I feel, William Castle's desire to kind of move away from the gimmick type movies and into a more adult type of picture. So the later pictures like Straightjacket and Nightwalker, some of those are he's trying to gear more toward the adult audience. But then you've got, you know, Zots and 13 Frightened Girls, which are definitely still for the kiddies. But Homicidal, it was clearly capitalizing on the success of Psycho, which, you know, this great story that a friend of William Castle's tells in the documentary about how he had this real high after making 13 Ghosts, and you know, everybody was loving the movie and it was a big hit. But then he left a screening one night, and he looked across the street at a theater that was playing Psycho, and there was lines wrapped around the block, and he realized that Alfred Hitchcock was employing some of the same techniques that William Castle had been using to get the audiences in. You know, in the case of Psycho, it was a gimmick that you weren't able to enter the theater after the movie started, which I don't know that happens too much now, but back in the day, you'd go, if you got into a movie an hour in, you would just sit down, watch the movie until the end, and just stay and watch it from the beginning and then leave where you came in. And Alfred Hitchcock said, no, you're not going to be allowed to do that. And that got him a lot of press. And that was a gimmick in the same way that Bill Castle had gimmick. So I'm sure Homicidal was, I have no doubt Homicidal was a reaction to the success of Psycho in terms of the gimmick, in terms of the theme of the movie, that now you were actually able to make a movie about a guy dressing up as a girl or vice versa. And it was okay to now talk about these things, especially if somebody was running around killing people the way they did in Psycho, the way Norman Bates did in Psycho.
Yeah, that's the thing too, is like some of the things that we've talked about are men being forced to dress as women, or men identifying more with women, you know, even thinking like Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs. But to have a woman dressing as a man, it's, again, we're getting into really rare territory as far as what we see in movies. I mean, we don't necessarily get that drag king kind of idea in films nearly as often as, you know, immediately my mind goes to Dress to Kill. You know, it's like we almost always are seeing men dressing as women and doing these killings or having gender problems and then killing, but we're not seeing women dressing as men and doing killings nearly as often.
No, like I said, the only things that I can think of women dressing as men are related to trying to pass through a situation like a Twelfth Night, or as Jeffrey brought up, also Yentl, you know, in some way. It's not women dressing as men is not a end up leading to someone getting killed usually.
I mean, there's Victor Victoria with a man pretending to be a woman, pretending to be a man kind of thing.
But a woman pretending to be a man is not a threat to the natural order of things. There's something kind of charming about it. But a man dressing as a woman, that's the end of everything. And that's where you get into trouble. And that's where you start seeing, you know, the films like Dress to Kill, where there must be something deeply wrong with anyone, any man who would, you know, lower himself to dress like a woman or to even want to be a woman. That's the worst thing that you could possibly do in our society.
Yeah, that whole idea of trying to get out of your responsibilities as a man by being a woman and just adopting the trappings of the weaker sex. I mean, gosh, you know, heaven forbid that actually happen.
Well, it's deeply misogynistic. You know, I mean, I think a lot of the transphobia has to do with misogyny and fear and the hatred of women, you know. So that makes Homicidal unique and kind of separate from the transgender psycho killer that we've seen in a lot of other movies, Dress to Kill and Silence of the Lambs and other films.
So you've talked a little bit about some of the gimmicks that we had in some of these other Castle films, and sometimes I'm afraid that the gimmicks kind of overshadow the work when it comes to Castle, because these films are great. These films are remarkable, and I don't think that Homicidal needed a gimmick at all. In fact, when it comes up, I was laughing, and I probably shouldn't have been laughing at this point, but I mean, it still works for me. The fright break that is inside of Homicidal works as a nostalgia kind of thing, but really I think it could be just cut out and play like a quote-unquote straight film without any problem. Now, were there other things? Which was the one where Castle was selling like life insurance, or he had the Coward's Corner? What movies were those?
Well, it all started, Castle was a B contract director at Columbia, and he was making movie after movie after movie, but they didn't really have a personal stamp, and he was kind of an anonymous guy. But he wanted to break out of that, and he wanted to be known. So he ended up doing a film called Macabre, which was inspired by Diabolique. And he saw the lines outside the theater for Diabolique, and he wanted to make a shocker like that, like a low-budget, black-and-white shocker. So he made a movie called Macabre, but because he had personally mortgaged his house and personally, you know, had his own finances were on the line, if the movie was not a success, he would be in big trouble. So what he decided to do was come up with a gimmick to ensure that the people would actually show up. So what he did was he took out a life insurance policy with Lloyd's of London. In case the audience died, if somebody died of fright during the movie, your beneficiary would collect $1,000, and he put it in all the ads, and he put it in all the trailers. And I don't believe anyone actually died as a result of it, but it would have been great publicity. And for all these years, I always thought that was kind of a put-on. Could he really have gotten a life insurance policy from Lloyd's of London? But when I was making the documentary, Spine Tingler, I was over at Terry Castle's house, his daughter, and we were looking through all the files, and we actually found the real life insurance policy from Lloyd's of London. So he actually did this. And then after Macabre, it was a huge hit, and he wanted to follow it up immediately after that, which he did with The House on Haunted Hill, where he came up with a gimmick called Emerjo. And Emerjo was a skeleton that would fly out on a wire over the audience at a certain point in the movie. And after that, that was also a huge hit, and that, of course, he followed up with The Tingler, where he installed electric buzzers under the seats that would go off at a certain point in the movie. 13 Ghosts, we mentioned, had special glasses where you could see the ghosts or not see the ghosts. So he was kind of getting typecast for these kinds of films, and I know that he wanted to move away from them. And Homicidal, he would come up with the gimmick before the plot of the movie. So my guess is that the idea of the gimmick for Homicidal, which was, there's actually two gimmicks in Homicidal. One was a certificate that you got upon entering the theater was where you could get your money back if you couldn't stand to watch the shocking ending of the movie. But the shocking ending of the movie is the scene you're talking about where the character is walking toward a closed door, and behind that closed door is all sorts of mayhem, and you hear William Castle's voice come on.
This is the Fright Break. You hear that sound? It's the sound of a heartbeat. A frightened, terrified heart. Is it beating faster than your heart or slower? This heart is going to beat for another 25 seconds. To allow anyone to leave this theater who is too frightened to see the end of the picture. Ten seconds more, and we go into the house. It's now or never. Five, four, you're a brave audience. Two, one.
And what it was, he called it the Fright Break. And the Fright Break was basically a clock that was going backwards. So that was the first gimmick. The sort of coup de grace of this gimmick was the Coward's Corner. And the Coward's Corner was, if you did decide to get your money back, you'd have to leave the theater. And some people say there were yellow lines leading up to the exit. You know, you were a chicken and you were yellow. And then you would walk up out and you'd have to stand in the Coward's Corner, which is basically just a cardboard box, like a holding pen for all the cowards. And you'd have to stand in there. And as the audience came out after the movie was over, they would see you in there and they would obviously be laughing at you and deriding you for not, you know, having the guts to see the end of the movie.
If you are too frightened to stay to see the rest of the picture, you can present this certificate at the Coward's Corner and get your full admission price refunded.
And that actually worked, and that was a sensational gimmick for William Castle. But before, they had some test screenings of it, and they showed it in Youngstown, Ohio. And what happened was they showed the movie, and before the end of the movie, the entire audience got up and left, and they all wanted their money back. And Castle was shocked and horrified. How could this be? And it turns out that this audience bought tickets for the earlier show, sat through the movie a second time, and then got up and left to try to get their money. So he realized that the people of Youngstown, Ohio were swindlers, and they had to come up with a system of different colored tickets so that nobody could try to outsmart William Castle.
The break there, it works, but at the same time, I think pulls modern viewers out of the film a little bit, is the fact that outside of the opening, we don't hear him again. It's not like he's narrating throughout the entire film, and then it pops up at that point. And for me, I was just sort of like, today it just seems a little, you know, it's gimmicky, but
well,
it just seems, yeah. But
yeah.
And I understand the reasons behind his gimmicks, but in this one, I was like, I wish it just would have played straight through. Like Mike was saying, you could have just cut it out.
I have a feeling that they did do that for. They would probably had prints without the gimmicks. I know for Mr. Sardonicus that was the film where you could vote whether or not the villain lives or dies at the end of the movie by holding up a little thumb, a glow in the dark thumb. You know, thumbs up, he dies. No, thumbs up, he lives. Thumbs down, he dies. But Castle knew that nobody would vote for the villain to live, so they only shot one ending of the movie anyway. So when they show it on TV, and I think one of the DVD early DVD prints has a version without the gimmick. So yeah, I agree with you, Rob. For audiences today who don't know about this, it's like, who is this guy suddenly coming on at the end of the movie and telling me that I can like leave my living room and get my money back? It's very confusing. But like I said, at that point, I think Castle was starting to tire of the gimmicks, and he. If you look at the next films after Mr. Sardonicus, you know, Straitjacket didn't have a gimmick or need a gimmick because he had Joan Crawford. And with Joan Crawford, you don't need a gimmick.
Joan Crawford was the gimmick.
Well, all movie stars are gimmicks, right?
When it comes to you, Jeffrey, you know, you made Spine Tingler, the William Castle story, but you were also doing a lot of extras for all these DVD re-releases of Castle's films. Which came first?
Well, when I... moved to LA, my goal, that was in about 1995, my goal and desire was to make the William Castle documentary, but I had no real way to do it. I had just moved here. It was many years ago, and I thought, well, I'll just call Columbia Pictures and I'll pitch them the documentary because they owned all the William Castle movies. And that I was a little bit naive because studios don't generally do that. But when I went to Columbia or Sony to pitch the idea, I met a guy there named Mike Stratford. And Mike Stratford was hired to run this new division of a new format, DVD. And this was in like 98, 99. And they were actually hiring independent producers to do what they called added value content for the DVDs to convince everyone to get rid of their VHSs and buy this new format. So he ended up hiring me to produce the DVD extras for The Tingler and Night of the Living Dead, the Tom Savini version, back in 1999. So even though they didn't give me the green light, let's say, to make a feature documentary, they hired me to do The Tingler featurette, which we did, and then they hired me to do I think four or five other ones in the years after. So I did featurettes for Homicidal and 13 Ghosts and Straitjacket and Mr. Sardonicus. But I always had it in my mind that I wanted to do the feature. So I just started shooting interviews on my own over the course of it took about 10 years to do it. And then when I finally had enough interviews, I asked Sony if they would let me have all of the materials that I shot for the DVD. They were very gracious, and they let me have all the interviews that I shot. And I edited the movie together as a feature called Spine Tingler. We made the film, and we got it into the AFI Fest back in 2007, and we premiered it there. That was our world premiere, and it was a big success. I won the audience award at that festival, and I remember we needed to have some ballyhoo for that film because it's about William Castle, the greatest showman. So what I decided to do was I got a replica of the Tingler, and both myself and Terry Castle, Bill's daughter, walked around the premiere opening night with a Tingler on our back, and I was walking the red carpet with a Tingler on the same red carpet that Tom Cruise was on for, what was that movie he did, Lions for Lambs, the one with Meryl Streep years ago. And yeah. So he was about 20 feet away from me, and all the reporters were talking to me. I'm like, why do I have this thing on my back? And it was wild, and it just proved, you know, this hunk of plastic that I had, this replica of the Tingler, got us a lot of attention, and it really helped. So that's how the film Spine Tingler came about, and then Sony ended up letting me use all the clips from all the films. They were really gracious about the whole thing, and they ended up licensing the documentary and put it on their box set, the William Castle box set, which is, I think it's out of print now, but the documentary is still available in a variety of ways.
So we've essentially just given the audience at home a fright break here, because we're now need to dive into the third act of the film. I gotta say, it's so effective. You know, I talked about all of those shadows, and it's just this, the air is thick with shadows as Merriam-Webster, sorry,
yeah. Yeah.
As she walks through this house and is trying to figure out what's going on. And we hear that tapping of Helga's doorknob on the wheelchair, and Helga coming down the stairs in this mechanical device, the same kind of thing that we saw in Gremlins and other places. And which, of course, the stairway, I'm immediately thinking, you know, in the earlier scene where Emily almost kills Helga on the stairway, I'm thinking of Arbogast in Psycho, you know, and there's even some good, like, kind of moving in, zooming in kind of thing. Not that zoom in, pull out thing that we get with Arbogast, but there's some still effective camera work here. And I do have to say that the revelation of Helga being decapitated really did put the whammy on me. I was so shocked when we see the shadow of her head roll off of her shoulders. It really, if I had been in an audience, I might have squealed.
I think I did squeal, actually, when that head fell off. What an audience. What a moment for the audience. Because that's – you didn't see that kind of thing. You really did not see that kind of thing in a mainstream – I don't know if you'd call this mainstream, but in a Hollywood movie. I mean, Herschel Gordon Lewis was doing that kind of thing on a very low budget for drive-ins. But that was way out there. I mean, this was a mainstream kind of film.
And that's where I, you know, noted the – Tales from the Crypt kind of thing, because I could see a panel like that in those comics at the time, those horror comics that were around a few years before in the late 50s and caused all those, you know, congressional hearings and all that nonsense. So I just remember like images like that, the whole shadow and sort of like the head falling off and all of that being in those comics. So like, it just really has that kind of feel. It has that edge to it. That's a little bit, like you were saying, that's not mainstream. Like, Hitchcock wouldn't have put that in one of his films.
And the revelation of Emily into Warren, I thought was great. And I was glad that she did, you know, put those teeth in or take the teeth out and just kind of, she put teeth in, that's what it was, to kind of further that thing. Because really, other than the hair and the dubbed in voice, there wasn't a whole lot of difference. I mean, there wasn't, you know, it was a good transformation as far as, you know, she didn't, we didn't have to believe that she was putting on, you know, tons of makeup or anything like that to transform from the one character to another, because she could do it like that. And so it was great to see how the transformation happened.
Also, it helps that that actress is not someone that anyone had ever heard of or had ever seen in any other movies. I mean, she's credited as Jean Arliss in Homicidal. And I did see some promotional photos that Jean Arliss took with William Castle. There's a great photo that's in Spine Tingler of them with Hitchcock's head on like a Thanksgiving dinner table. And they're like carving up Hitchcock's head, which is hilarious. And Jean Arliss is dressed as a witch. And it's just wild. And I've seen some great photos. I don't know where they would have run because it would give away the ending. But there's photos I have of Jean Arliss getting her hair cut, you know, as a man's haircut. But Jean Arliss was actually Joan Marshall, who was, that was her real name, and she was a working actress. She actually played Lily Munster in the pilot episode of The Munsters. That she didn't end up playing Lily, but if you can find the pilot episode, the rest of the cast, like Al Lewis is in it and Fred Gwynne, but it's Jean Arliss, I'm rather Joan Marshall playing Lily, and she was married to Hal Ashby. And that's about all I know about her. I'm kind of fascinated with who Joan Marshall really was, because she was clearly a Hollywood fixture.
Right. Yeah, and it's funny that you say Hal Ashby, because I noticed that she was in Shampoo. And I'm like, oh,
that's
okay.
Right. She's in Shampoo. That's right. I forgot about that.
Obviously, it's clever to call her Jean rather than Joan, because then you have the, you know, the more transitory name. You know, it's not G-E-N-E, but, you know, you could still possibly get that. You know, of course, it always reminds me of the It's Pat sketches from Saturday Night Live, where it's all of those names where you can't really tell if it's a man or a woman. So hearing Jean, you're like, is this Jean Harlow or Jean Hackman?
Gene the Dancing Machine.
And I wonder how much William Castle had to do with that, you know, the creation of the Jean Arliss persona, or, you know, and what the press was. Because this was a mystery. This was a mystery person, and then the public didn't know anything about her.
God, I can't even imagine what his press packs must have looked like back in the day. Because, you know, when we were doing Black Cat a few weeks ago, and Ed Pettit was reading off some of the ideas from the press materials for, you know, bring the kids to the movie and have them, you know, draw their favorite blah blah blah, and it's just like the ideas that Castle must have had in order to help promote a movie in a venue must have just been incredible, and they must just have been outrageous.
Yeah, we found photos in Sony's archives of a guy walking around outside of the theater with painted yellow with like a sandwich board saying, you know, come see Homicidal. There actually were nurses at the theater. I mean, the nurses at the theater were famously used in Macabre, because he would have the nurses pass out the life insurance policy. And in Homicidal, I've seen pictures of nurses in the lobby taking people's blood pressure and making sure that they're not too faint of heart to see the movie. So yeah, he pulled out all the stops for Homicidal, because there's like I said, there was multiple gimmicks. There's the certificate that you get when you walk in, that you get your money back, and then there's also the Coward's Corner, the Fright Break. So that there's three gimmicks. You actually get to take something home with you, which was always great. You had the Fright Break, and you had the Coward's Corner.
So we made some comparisons between Homicidal and Psycho. And obviously there are many visual references going on throughout this, and the whole idea of the transgenderism and the way that Norman, when he was threatened, would become the mother character or mother figure. And I've always said that, and I don't know of a better way where you could actually handle this, but I've always said that the end of Psycho is pretty ham-fisted when it comes to the psychiatrist explaining away Norman's problems. And we get almost beat per beat to a point that same kind of thing in this film, where we get the explanation of the Emily and Warren. But I do have to say that we've already gotten a lot of things established when it comes to Emily being Warren or vice versa. So it's not as hammy to me. It just feels like this guy's kind of explaining it more to the people in the room than necessarily explaining it all to the audience, though in effect he is explaining it to the audience as well.
Well, if you feel that that last scene in Psycho was a detriment and Homicidal is an improvement on that, then you wouldn't be the only one, because Time magazine, when they reviewed Homicidal, they actually said it was better than Psycho when they did their yearly roundup of the movies of the year. So that must have been such a thrill for William Castle, because he was always following Hitchcock's career, and they did, like I said, have a friendly rivalry. So to have the magazine of note say that his movie was better than Hitchcock's, that he must have been over the moon about that.
Did Castle do those kind of promo trailers as well as the the introductions to his films?
Yeah, Homicidal has one where he explains the Fright Break and explains the certificate and the Coward's Corner, and he's in all the trailers. He's in many of the movies, TV spots and radio spots, and he was all over the country barnstorming the country with these movies, because a movie like Homicidal wouldn't have opened all over the country at once. It would have opened city by city by city, and he would have been there in person to ballyhoo the movie.
I was curious, because one of the most famous things for me when it comes to Psycho, yes, there's the poster with Hitchcock pointing at his watch about the 20 minutes late that you talked about earlier, but also that promo film that was shot for Psycho, where he goes through and he talks about the toilet and all these things.
I'll tell you, there's a very important clue was found here. Down there. Well, the murderer, you see, crept in here very slowly. Of course, the shower was on, there was no sound. And
which to me just felt like he must have been on set of Alfred Hitchcock Presents and said, okay, guys, you know, roll camera. Let's do this promo for Psycho kind of thing. And it seems to me that he didn't necessarily do that for other things. There wasn't a little promo for Stage Fright, as far as I know, or Shadow of a Doubt. So I'll have to go back and make sure that that's really the case. But it seems like Psycho was an exception to the way that Hitchcock was presenting these things, but and that does feel to me like he was aping Castle a little bit.
Oh, certainly, and just even the choice to do Psycho, because he was doing these big glossy, color movies in VistaVision, and to do Psycho, it was a gritty, low budget horror film with shocking subject matter shot by his TV crew, and these were the kinds of movies that that Bill Castle was doing. So I'm sure, and Hitchcock was a businessman and a great showman as well. So I'm sure that he saw what Castle was doing and saw an opportunity to sort of get into that market in terms of the drive-in market or the Roger Corman type films or the William Castle type films. I love the promo film that Bill Castle made in the Youngstown, Ohio. This is the city of the swindlers who sat through. But I watched this thing so many times, and it's so hilarious because he's talking to the patrons, his audience, and there's this one moment where it's a couple of guys saying, "Mr. Castle, we just saw your movie, and we think, you know, Alfred Hitchcock's going to have to go a long way to top this one." You know, it's clear that they've been coached. And then there's a moment where somebody almost gives away the ending, the shocking ending, and William Castle is like, "Oh, no, you know, don't give away the ending." And in one point in this promo, he turns to the camera and says, "Don't give away the ending of Homicidal, or I will kill you."
"Don't reveal the ending of Homicidal to your friends, or they will kill you. If they don't, I will."
You could probably find that on the YouTube and watch it because it's so entertaining. And it's also really touching to see this kind of ballyhoo because it's like the circus was coming to town. You know, when Castle would come to your town, this is a real Hollywood director coming to town and interacting with the people. And he really enjoyed that part of the process. He would go and stand in the back of the theater and hear the reactions and make sure the films were working the way they were supposed to be working. He had personal relationships with the exhibitors, the theater owners, even the ushers, you know, and the people who worked in the theaters. He knew them by their names. And I you don't really see that kind of thing today. You definitely don't see that kind of thing today.
All right, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back after a few brief messages.
"Hey, it's the Schwarzenegger. I need your clothes, your boots, and your podcast device. Why? Because this October, on the Films and Swearing Movie Podcast, the boys will be reviewing all 5 Terminator movies. Yes, all 5. Even Rise of the Machines, Talk to the Hand, and Search Films and Swearing on your podcast apps, iTunes, Skynet, and Stitcher Radio, or visit filmsandswearing.com. If not, consider it a divorce."
"That's fucking Tall Rico."
"Fuck you, asshole."
"Let me ask you a question. Are you getting enough? I bet you'd love more, right? Well, AdamandEve.com wants to give you more with 10 free gifts. First, you'll get a sexy surprise for her. Second, a specially selected toy for him. And third, a little something we know you'll both enjoy. Plus, you'll get 6 full-length adult movies on DVD. And number 10, free shipping on your entire order. So what do you have to do to get your 10 free gifts? It's not hard. Just go to AdamandEve.com and select any one item. It could be an adventurous new toy, sexy piece of lingerie, or anything you desire. Just enter offer code BOOTH at checkout, and you'll get all 10 free gifts. Go check out AdamandEve.com today. Select one item and get 10 free gifts, including free shipping, when you enter offer code BOOTH. That's B-O-O-T-H at AdamandEve.com.
"Hey fans, this is Reverend Scott. Just want to tell you about Outside the Cinema. Great company. They review cult films, any cult film, every cult film. And it's something you should tune into. So if you get a chance, go to the website, look these guys up, Outside the Cinema, and find out what the hot cult films are today, what's going on. These guys are right on the cutting edge of reviewing cult movies. And if you're a cult member, or you want to be a cult member, you're thinking about being a cult member, your mom's a cult member, your dad's a cult member, your damn mother-in-law's a cult member, tune in to Outside the Cinema, baby, and you'll find out what's going on. Reverend Scott, and that's out."
It's homicidal.
and we're talking about Homicidal with Jeffrey Schwartz this week. Jeff, you know, you've done a decent amount of documentaries. You've done all these DVD extras, and we've talked to you before about a couple of the films that you've done. Obviously, I Am Divine, and the latest, which did play in town here in Detroit, and sadly could not make it out, Tab Hunter Confidential.
Well, hopefully we'll be back. Tab Hunter Confidential is still on the festival circuit, but we're gearing up for a multi-city theatrical release. And actually, there's some ballyhoo going on with this release because Tab Hunter will be appearing in person at many of these screenings in New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, all over the country. You can find out where we're playing on our website, tabhunterconfidential.com, and also our Facebook page.
And we talked a little bit with you when you were in the process of putting this together, but can you kind of give us the background on it, why you decided Tab Hunter?
I met Tab Hunter when we were making I Am Divine, and I interviewed Tab and his partner, Alan Glasser, because Tab obviously starred with Divine in Polyester, and Alan and Tab produced Divine's movie Lust in the Dust. So I got to know them both, and I had read Tab's fantastic autobiography about 10 years ago, and I just sort of started talking to them about doing a documentary on his life. And it turns out they were already thinking about that and were thinking about who might be the right person to direct it. And we all started working together. That was about 6.5 years ago by now. The film took about 6 years to make. And I just thought it was a great opportunity to hear from the horse's mouth about what it was like to be a matinee idol, one of the last of the studio contract players, one of the last of the movie stars of the golden age in the 50s, and also that he was living a double life. He was a gay man, but he was being sold to the American public as God's gift to women. And what was that like, you know, in an extremely repressive, homophobic time? And so I think that we got the answers to all those questions in the film.
I think that in a way, when you look at him and maybe, I guess, the image of Rock Hudson sort of in the similar era, that there were these gay men who had to not be out, and they were seen, as you were saying, God's gift to women. So, you know, not to give it all away, but what did he see as those conflicts in himself? How hard was it to deal with those issues for himself?
Well, there's the personal side of things, and then there's the professional side of things. In terms of the person, I mean, this is the 50s, and it was literally impossible to be openly gay. You know, there were, you know, very dire circumstances for anybody who would dare to, you know, speak of this. In Hollywood, it was a little easier. You could be openly gay in Hollywood if you worked behind the scenes. There certainly weren't any openly gay actors or actresses. It was poison to a career and to a life, to be honest. But Tab, on a personal level, he was raised Roman Catholic. He had a very strict mother. He went to Catholic school. He was taught by nuns. And he was growing up at a time where being gay was just not discussed, but you also knew that it was wrong. It was sinful. It was illegal to be gay. He had to come to terms with that, and it took him a long time to come to terms with that. And he was also living in the public eye, and he considered marriage. You know, there were actors who did, they used to call them lavender marriages, either where there was a gay man marrying a woman or a gay man marrying a lesbian. Tab did see other actors do this. Rock Hudson did it. He married his agent's secretary, Henry Wilson, who, by the way, was also Tab Hunter's agent. Rock and Tab had the same agent. And Tab had a relationship with a woman, one of his co-stars, that he did consider marrying. But he had kind of a code of honor, and he didn't want to have a relationship based on lies, you know. So he decided he wouldn't get married to a woman. And in fact, he did have a relationship with Tony Perkins for several years. That was a very important relationship in his life, among other relationships. But, you know, the idea that these two major, major stars, and they were sort of at the peak of their stardom when they were seeing each other, you know, but they had to go out. If they would go out together, they would go on double dates, or they would bring a beard. And we interviewed one of the beards in the movie, who was very happy to be a beard because she had a great time hanging out with the boys and going out to nightclubs. But if they would go out together, Tony would sometimes wear a disguise. You know, he'd wear a long coat and a baseball cap. And if they would go to the movies together, they would go separately and sort of meet up when the movie started. They had to sort of live very circumspect lives. You know, but now it's decades and decades later, and Tab's come full circle with this. He's learned to accept himself.
You know, I think about that era of the tabloid journalist, and it's not to say that, you know, with our TMZ world and the online and everything that we have now, but it seemed a little bit more different back then in terms of they were looking for those scoops. They were trying to out people, the old, you know, confidential magazine type things. Did he ever have to run into that sort of aspect when he was in his heyday, when he was the contract player?
The mainstream movie magazines and the mainstream columnists like Hedda Hopper or Luella Parsons, I mean, they were all part of the movie industry, and they would never publish a negative story about a star because then they wouldn't have access to that star. And the studios controlled the actors very tightly, and they also controlled the press. So there was sort of a conspiracy of silence about the gay issue. I mean, no columnist would ever dream of bringing that up. But then sometimes you would see sort of, if you read between the lines, you know, somebody referred to as a bachelor or something like that. But then there were the other magazines like Confidential, and that was sort of a new breed of tabloid journalism that came along. Confidential magazine was definitely not in the studio's pocket, and their stories always had sort of a grain of truth in them, but they were highly exaggerated. So Tab, when he was just starting out as an actor, he was arrested at a gay party very early on, before he was well known at all. And it was illegal for gay people to congregate together at a party, even in a private home. So he was arrested. He was bailed out. It was still on his record, but it was under his old name of Art Galeen. And years later, when he was going to leave his agent, Henry Wilson, Henry retaliated by releasing this information to Confidential magazine, because Confidential was going to publish a story about Rock Hudson, who was also a client. So Henry kind of threw Tab under the bus, gave them this information, and Confidential published a story about Tab being arrested, and they said it was in a limp-wristed pajama party, which is, you know, everyone knows what that means. But they never came out and outed him, but, you know, it was clear what that meant. But weirdly, that didn't really affect his career. Tab thought it was the end of the world at the time. But Confidential wasn't really taken very seriously, and they didn't have the kind of readership that one of the more mainstream magazines, like a Photoplay, or, you know, Hedda Hopper's column or Luella Parsons' column would have. So it's fascinating to look back at that time where, you know, the actors were products, and the Tab Hunter was sort of a character that was created. It was a persona that was created by the studios to sell tickets and to sell magazines. He was probably more famous for the magazine covers and his hit rock and roll singles than he was for the movies he was making.
For you in doing the film Tab Hunter Confidential, what was something for yourself that you came to realize about this person who maybe you only knew from, you know, the films he was in or even before you read the book in some way?
You know, I was very touched by, I mentioned this sort of code of honor that he has. And, you know, he's a person of faith. He was, like I said, raised Roman Catholic, and he did leave the church for many years because of their condemnation of him. He did actually confess to a priest when he was young and he was having these feelings for men, and he got a very negative reaction and kind of terrified him. And he was away from the church for decades. So, but he did come back to the church, and it was interesting. I don't share those beliefs. I'm not a person of faith the way Tab is. But I really respect his dedication to the church, because he found a way to take what he needs from it. He rejects all the dogma and the condemnation, and he just has like a personal spiritual relationship with God, or, you know, however he chooses to define it, I guess. And that I found really touching and very real. He goes to church every week. You know, he's kind of what you see is what you get with him. And I thought it was just a really fascinating way to look at the closet, and particularly the 1950s, where nothing is what it seemed. There was something going on. It was definitely the Blue Velvet, David Lynch, you know, shiny, happy surfaces. But behind it, there is a lot more going on that people just didn't know about, chose to ignore. And now we can look at that time with a whole new perspective.
You know, one of the things that amazes me is looking at, like, the whole idea of, like, if you are outed in this time, it is just career death kind of thing. And then comparing that to something like Neil Patrick Harris a few years ago being outed, and he's just like, yep, that's me. This is who I am. Where do you see was there a particular moment for you where you saw actors who were being outed or actors who were coming out that being okay versus this is potential career death. Like, I'm looking at like a Rupert Everett, where it's just like once he came out, the roles seem to dry up for him. Whereas Neil Patrick Harris has had untold success, or like a, you know, Ellen DeGeneres, you know, it was, that was such a scandal at the time when she came out. But now it's like Ellen Page comes out, no big deal. Or at least that's the way I perceive it. Is it me getting older, or was there kind of a sea change when it comes to the acceptability of your favorite matinee idols being gay?
Well, I don't know that we have any matinee idols who are out. I mean, I think we do have, we have comedians, we have talk show hosts, we have character actors, but we don't have leading men, leading women that are out. And although it is a lot... it's, you actually can come out in a career and still maintain your career. Usually the people who come out either have been out from the beginning, like Rupert Everett was always out. It wasn't like he made a big pronouncement. He was just always out. And then he got a role in the big Julia Roberts movie, and then the career, he kept working, but he didn't turn into a big movie star like people thought he might. And some people attributed that to him, you know, being openly gay. I think the way a lot of the leading men handle rumors is saying, well, I know I finally made it there's a rumor about me, you know. But it's still a business, and it's still considered a detriment to a career. There are plenty of actors who would like to be out who are told they shouldn't be out by their management. And I understand that. I mean, it's hard enough to maintain a career as an actor or an actress in Hollywood without that perceived that perceived problem being held against you, you know? So I guess it remains to be seen. I think that actually the world is ready for an openly gay movie star, but we now are in a global market of movies, and movies are made for the entire world, and there are plenty of places in the world where they might not even book that film. You know, I'm not saying he's gay, but let's say George Clooney came out tomorrow and you were trying to sell his movie to Saudi Arabia, you might have a problem doing that. So it's a very interesting time, but it's certainly not a career suicide to come out of the closet the way it would have been. And nobody would have dreamed of doing that in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s. Yeah, people started doing that. But Lily Tomlin was actually asked to come out early in her career, in probably the mid-70s, by Time magazine. And she declined. You know, she would have been the first. If she had done that, she would have been the first sort of mainstream, you know, she was sort of a movie star at that time, to come out. She didn't do it, and I don't think the world would have been ready for it at that point. It certainly would have hurt her career then. Now she can do it, and nobody thinks twice about it.
I heard a rumor, and I don't know if you can confirm or deny this, but I once heard that Paul Lynde was gay. Is that true?
Oh, couldn't possibly be.
Okay.
Then next you're going to tell me Liberace was.
Ooh, yeah. No, I don't think so. I think he sued people and won when they accused him of being
gay.
That's
the other thing. You know, Paul Lynde was never out of the closet. Liberace never came out of the closet. You know, all these sort of big queens that we know about never came out. And you could be as outrageous as you wanted to be and be a big queen like Liberace, but the minute you actually said it, it would be over, you know? And he, like, you're right. He did actually sue a newspaper for insinuating that he was gay, and he won. And those were just the times. So I don't know. I mean, Richard Simmons, I don't know what his inclinations are, but he's not out. And he reminds me a little bit of the Paul Lynde and the Liberace, because he can be as outrageous as he wants to be, but he just won't actually say the words.
So speaking of outrageous, or shall we say fabulous, can you tell us a little bit about The Fabulous Alan Carr, your new project?
Oh, yeah. Thanks for asking. It's a new film about Alan Carr, who was famous as a talent manager, a party thrower. He threw these fabulous Hollywood parties, and a movie producer. And he produced famously Grease and Can't Stop the Music and La Cage aux Folles on Broadway. And he's also responsible for the disastrous 1989 Academy Awards, the one that's famous for Snow White appearing and singing a duet with Rob Lowe, singing Proud Mary with Rob Lowe, and considered, you know, by many people the worst Oscars ever. I don't happen to agree with that. But anyway, he was a very flamboyant, larger-than-life movie producer personality that has had a fascinating life, and he's no longer with us, but there's a lot of people around who worked with him, and he was a very... A big presence in Hollywood in the 60s, 70s, and the, into the 80s, and into the 90s too, actually.
So where are you at with this project?
We just filmed our first interview a couple of weeks ago with Marlo Thomas, who was an early client of Cars. And we are heading to Chicago next week to start filming. And I hope by this time next year we'll have a finished movie. We'll see.
You'll have to let us know how it is tracking down all the original village
people. Well, I've been talking to a lot of them. Yeah, I've been in touch with the cowboy and the Indian, and there's only a few of the original lineup who are still around. But I'm hoping they'll all be in the film. There's lots of wild stories about the making of Can't Stop the Music, Nancy Walker's directorial debut. And actually going to be watching that movie in about an hour here for my birthday party. We're having a little Can't Stop the Music fiesta here at the Shea Schwarz.
Awesome. You know, if you get in with the Indian, you basically have the rest of the village people, because not too many people realize that it was the Indian who was pulling the strings the whole time.
Well, he was the one that started it all, really, because the producers of the village people were out clubbing one night and they saw the Indian who was a go-go dancer, and he was dancing on a bar. And they looked around this bar and they saw all these people dressed up as cops and leather guys and Indians and construction workers, and they thought, interesting. I think we might have something here. That's Felipe Rose is the Indian. And
yes, he does have a name.
He has a name, and he's in, that they're all in. And Can't Stop the Music is sort of a fictionalized version of the creation of the village people. And that was Alan Carr's idea. He saw the village people performing, and he went to see them backstage, and he says, I just came up with a movie idea for you. And he put that whole package together, and it was his follow-up to Grease, which was the biggest movie musical of all time. And he thought, wow, how could you go wrong with the village people? But when they started making the movie, they were, disco was king, and the village people were really popular. By the time the movie came out, there was a huge backlash against disco. There was that famous disco demolition derby. I think it was in Detroit. I have to double check that. But it was a radio DJ who did a stunt where people would bring their disco albums to the baseball field, and they would set them on fire and blow them up. And that was sort of the disco sucks, the beginning of the disco sucks era. And when, by the time Can't Stop the Music came out, the disco backlash was in full swing, and the movie completely bombed.
I don't want to disparage the people of Chicago, but that was actually an event that took place in Kaminsky Park in Chicago.
It was Chicago. Okay, good. It wasn't Detroit. Yeah. Thank goodness.
You know, the thing that's interesting about the whole disco sucks thing is, when you look at who was interested in disco, it seems like it's built upon this whole, once again, I guess, getting into anti-gay and also race to a certain extent, because it was obviously a music that appealed to gay community, black community, Latino community. And it seemed that rock and roll was the place of the white man. And I guess they weren't too happy with being knocked off the charts for a while or something.
Yeah, I think you're totally right about that. It certainly was a homophobic response, and there was probably some racism in there too, for sure.
Hey, if you're going to go homophobia, why not do racism too?
Roll it all up into one burrito. There you go.
Yeah, and I've seen the footage of this disco demolition, and it's like a Nazi rally. It's scary. I mean, the people are running out onto the field and blowing up their records and chanting horrible things, and it's a little frightening, to be honest.
I will say that there was a Detroit connection, though. It was actually, this took place between a doubleheader of the White Sox and the Tigers. So there were Detroiters present. Aha.
Well, I hope they didn't participate in the destroying of Donna Summer's records.
If Lou Whitaker was there, I'm sure that he stayed out of the fray.
One would hope.
All right, we're going to take another break and play a preview for next week's show.
Eliza, aren't you?
Yes.
My name is Emily. I've been looking for you. Leave this place. Ago, Everybody in this hotel disappeared. Every last person. A painter called Zweig, who lived here, closeted in his room, had found a key.
Tell me, with all those accidents, you think you'll give it up now?
I couldn't do that if I wanted to. Well, I won't give in.
That's right, we're back next week with another entry in our spooktacular Shocktober series. It's The Beyond with our special guest co-host, Troy Howarth, to talk about director Lucio Fulci. Before we go, we want to thank this week's special guest co-host, Jeffrey Schwartz. And Jeffrey, where is the best place for people to keep up with you and your upcoming release of Tab Hunter Confidential and all the stuff with the fabulous Alan Carr?
Well, Tab Hunter Confidential, they can check out our website, tabhunterconfidential.com. You can watch our trailer, see where we're screening. I have a website, jeffrey-schwarz.com, S-C-H-W-A-R-Z. Don't forget the dash in the middle. And fabulous Alan Carr, we have a Facebook page set up, and I've just started sending out some updates on the film, so people can look for that.
Well, cool. We will definitely be linked to all those places over at our website, which also has a dash, projection-booth.com. Thanks to everybody for listening to this show. Thanks again, Jeffrey, for coming on. You know, we've got a lot of great support lately with our recent entree into the world of Patreon. If you want to show your support, head on over to patreon.com/projectionbooth. It's just one more way that you can help us take over the world.
That was fun.
If you enjoy this show and want more people to know about it, head on over to iTunes, leave a comment, and rate it 5 stars. Make sure you like and share us on Facebook, and don't forget to follow us on Twitter. Just search for Christopher Media. Thank you in advance for supporting Christopher Media by clicking on the PayPal button and by clicking through to all the sponsors who support ChristopherMedia.net. Most importantly, we would like to take the time to extend an extra special thanks to you. Christopher Media could not exist without your support. Thank you for visiting ChristopherMedia.net, and thank you for listening. Christopher Media. Let's make some noise.